Well, it's certainly a treat having you in.
Sure, you bet. Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
It's a treat for me because I have followed your work for many, many years, especially back in the days when I used to be a conservative. I don't know. Most people seem to become more conservative as they get older, and I don't know. Somehow I've seemed to become more liberal in some respects. I used to be an avid reader of National Review, and I still read it occasionally. And the thing that I enjoyed about Right Reason is that it gave me a chance to catch up with your thinking over the past few years, because I've read some of these earlier books of yours, like The Jeweler's Eye and so forth.
Sure.
But that's past history.
Right, sure.
All history is past, I assume.
Yeah.
So this gives me a chance to, this Right Reason gave me a chance to find out what you were thinking. And there are several sections in the book that I particularly liked. I liked the section called Appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
I liked your essays on Ayn Rand, R.I.P., and John Lennon, and the long essay that you did on your hobby, harpsichord.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought, and I thought this was absolutely hilarious, the section you had on correspondence, where you had the interchange of letters. That was a very nice touch. But perhaps my favorite part of Right Reason dealt with the section called Reflecting, and this was the essay called Back to Prison. Which dealt with the Edgar Smith case.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason I was interested in that was that not too long ago, I was talking to William Styron. He had a similar instance in which he championed the man who was in the Massachusetts prison system, I believe, maybe Connecticut, and had worked very hard to get this man out and had promised to give him a place to stay. But before the man was to be paroled, he escaped, robbed and raped a woman, and was eventually caught. Styron was going to give him a job on his premises. Then, of course, we had the Norman Mailer.
Yeah, we had him just about the same time, within a year or so of each other.
Yeah, so here you had Mailer and the Jack Henry Abbott case, and Styron, and then you with Edgar Smith. I just wonder about that. I wonder, in retrospect, do you think that perhaps writers ought to leave the ends of justice to the judges and the juries?
Well, you got to remember that In the Edgar Smith case, the question was whether justice had been done, and I was convinced that at the very least there was reasonable doubt, and my conviction that there was reasonable doubt was eventually shared by a court of appeals and by the Supreme Court, so they overturned his conviction, so he had then to go back in and be retried, rather than do that with the consent of the prosecution. He pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and got out, he having already served 17 years, which is as much of a rap as he agreed to go for second-degree murder, and they agreed to give him a sentence equal to exactly as much time as he had already spent in jail. So that there was a serious question there as to whether he was in fact guilty, whereas Abbott was clearly guilty. Nobody doubted that he was guilty. In the case of Styron, I can't remember whether the question arose whether he was guilty or whether Styron was saying, even though he is guilty, I think he ought to be treated tenderly.
But yeah, I it's hard for me to remember that case either. Styron did a story in Esquire magazine about that.
That's right.
But I believe the man was guilty, but Styron felt that he had shown so much promise in prison that it was time for him to get out.
Yeah, right. You see, that was different from mine.
Would you do something like that again?
Well, sure. If I thought that the person was in fact unfairly convicted, but I suppose that I would probably instinctively be more cautious than I was with Edgar Smith. I spent about 7 years of my life on the Edgar Smith case, so I was at it for a long, long time. And you're reading the terminal essay I wrote on the subject. I think, as a matter of fact, in the last paragraph of that essay, I answered the question you just asked me, saying yes, I would in fact do it again.
Have you been keeping correspondence with Edgar Smith?
No. After this particular piece came out, he wrote me a letter in which
he charged in one or two sentences that Life magazine had paid his wife a fortune to lie about him. Well, Life magazine wasn't even aware of his wife's existence, let alone in any collaborative relationship with her. And that was the last I've heard of him. She divorced him, and I get Christmas cards and birthday cards from his mother. That's it. Every now and then I hear from the prosecutor who tells me that he is so nimble that he has to rush up to San Francisco about once every couple of years and keep him from easing out via the parole system, which, as you know, is pretty porous.
Let's go back a ways, and then we'll work our way back up to Right Reason. A year after you graduated from Yale in 1950, you wrote your first book, which was God and Man at Yale. Now, that book, that captured quite a lot of attention, didn't it, for a relatively young college graduate? I say relatively young because I know you had served 3 years in the military.
Yeah. No, it captured an incredible amount of attention. In fact, somewhere I read that it was the most reviewed book published in 1951. So the publisher, it got a tremendous amount of attention. It was a sensitive subject, it turned out. A lot of people were busting to talk about the question whether somebody other than the odd professor should have a voice in the value impact of a modern college. And there were a lot of people who sided with me.
Your political interests, were they quite apparent during your 4 years at Yale?
Yeah, they were. I was the editor of the school newspaper, and as such, wrote a daily editorial, so that I got a lot of infield practice at school.
The Ivy League schools have been criticized for being too liberal, and yet many of the graduates of Ivy League schools seem to me to become the most zealot of conservatives, because they go, especially at Yale, where they go into banking and high finance and this sort of thing. What kind of atmosphere was it, as you recall now, looking back at Yale in terms of political interest and activism?
Well, it was preponderantly liberal, to the extent that it was Republican. It was very pro-Eisenhower. You may remember back then the Republican Party was divided between the followers of Taft, who, ironically enough, was a trustee of Yale, and the backers of Eisenhower, who was widely disdained in colleges on the grounds that he was too literate to serve as president of Columbia University. But unquestionably, the Eisenhower wing was much stronger than the Taft wing, even among the undergraduates. And the, to give you an example, there was, I think, 23 professors in the Department of Political Science, and in the 1948 election, they went 23 out of 23 for Harry Truman over Dewey. So that suggests, roughly speaking, where the weight was.
Did you set out upon graduation to make a career writing for yourself?
No, I didn't. I wrote that book, and I joined the CIA. I joined the CIA in part because I was persuaded by somebody, a professor, who was very close to the intelligence community, that the Korean War was probably going to stretch on for a good period of time. And I thought it would be just as interesting to do something other than serve again in the infantry, where I had already served. So I went to CIA. But after 9 months of that, I quit and came up and joined the American Mercury, which was then run by William Bradford Huey. I lasted there 4 or 5 months. I got bored with that and quit to write another book. Then I went briefly into business, and then I started my magazine.
Tell me about how you were able to put together the ammunition to be able to publish the National Review.
Well, the ammunition was easy. The financing was not. By easy, I mean this, that in 1945, there simply wasn't a conservative journal, a conservative journal of opinion being published. The Freeman, which had served that purpose spasmodically, had been pretty much taken over by a think tank, the Foundation for Economic Education on the Hudson. And it was in no sense journalistic. They were always afraid of their tax exemption, so that it was pretty sleepy. And there were people who were hankering to write spirited copy, analyzing from a conservative point of view some current events. James Burnham, William Schlamm, Frank Meyer, Max Eastman, Whitaker Chambers, so that the problem was to raise $500,000 worth of capital, only two-thirds of which did I in fact raise over a period of 18 miserable, humiliating months. But here we are.
The National Review has had some sporadic financial problems over the years, hasn't it?
Not sporadic, constant.
Constant?
Yeah. No, all journals of opinion, as far as I know, lose money. We lose about 12% of our gross every single year, 12-13%, about $500,000. So we have to appeal to our readers once a year for help. But they've always come through.
Like National Public Radio.
Same problem.
It's the same thing.
Same problem.
Political writing, and you've written most of your writing, I guess, over the years, does eventually become collected into books such as Right Reason and The Jeweler's Eye.
Well, no, not most. About 10%.
Uh-huh.
And Right Reason contains about 10% of what I've written during the last 7 years.
Mm-hmm. I have a feeling that in the long run, when we're looking to the future and trying to assess where we stand and what we've done, I have a feeling that, like humor, political writing is perishable and doesn't hold up too well. Although I do read Mencken today, and while much of the political material that he has written about is dated, Mencken was such an interesting curmudgeon that his work still holds a great amount of attention. And you have written at least four novels of fiction.
Six.
Yeah. And I just wonder if in the long run, if say we're talking about a couple of generations hence, and someone goes through a secondhand bookstore, if there are any left, they seem to be dying off with great rapidity, and they uncover a Buckley there, I just wonder if the fiction might hold in the long run more than your political writing.
Well, it's much easier for that to happen. Fiction, after all, gives you a narrative, and that narrative is almost always more entertaining than analysis, so that almost in the nature of things you'd probably be right. Now, the question of whether what I write politically will be looked at 10, 15, 20 years from now, I don't know. I'm occasionally encouraged, as when I see the reprinting of books that were first published 25 years ago, which has happened to two of my books. That's a nice feeling. On the other hand, I don't have any huge, obsessive appetite to last historically. I'm perfectly satisfied if my books have an impact over the short term. If they have stylistic impact that exceeds the short term, fine. But let somebody else be the judge of that. As you know, nobody has successfully predicted who's going to be read 25 years from now at any moment in history, with the exception of, say, Shakespeare.
Would you like some water?
I'll take my... Every day I fly, I have to take three of these the next day or I get a cold.
What?
Actifed.
Actifed. Well, that's that's for nasal congestion.
Yeah, and antihistamine.
Oh, yeah, I remember. That happened to me once where I did not take something like that, and was coming down with a cold. I got off the plane in Houston, Texas, and my ears were bleeding.
Oh, yeah.
And I was in such agony that I went. The first thing I did when I got off the plane at the Delta Terminal was to go, not to get you. I'm going to have to get you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt this.
No, that's all right. Hang on a second.
Okay. Did I screw things up?
No,
by doing
no,
that?
This never runs the way.
We were taping, weren't we?
We are taping,
yeah.
And it's strictly edited. So
thanks a lot.
But that scared me. That never happened to me before, and I was in such pain. I went to the emergency room of the hospital.
Great heavens!
And I swore that I would be very careful about that, because the pressure in the airplane, no matter if it's pressurized, you still have that problem.
Yeah. The trick on that, I've been told, and I do say it about scuba diving, is to keep clearing your whatever they call it inside the ear continuously. Don't wait until the pain is very sharp, but wait until it's just slight and then do it. So that, for instance, diving down, say, 70 feet, I would be clearing, as they call it, maybe 15 times. That makes it easy. But if you try to do it two or three times, then it can stick there and you can't ease it off. So that's Dr. Buckley giving you advice.
Well, back to let's go back to writing. You have written a number of fiction books, six novels, you say.
Seven, actually, but the seventh hasn't been published until March.
Well, your hero, Blackford Oakes, in the spy novels, he bears a great deal of resemblance to his creator. I don't believe, however, you were born in Toledo, Ohio, but...
People have said that, and... In fact, it's not true. We were both at Yale at around the same time. That was simply a matter of convenience.
You were born on December 7th, were you?
No.
1925.
No. He's an engineering major. He's a Protestant. He's full-time CIA. I was part-time CIA. He's unmarried. I'm married. So the differences are pretty distinct. Now, he tends to be an anti-communist conservative, as of course I am, but that leaves an awful lot that isn't necessarily embraced. I'm amused because I always recall at this juncture a review by, it was a professor at the University of Missouri, I think, reviewing my first novel for the Kansas City Star, and he had obviously abominated me in all of my works and thoughts throughout my public career, but he couldn't quite dislike this novel, and that tormented him. So he ended it by saying, Mr. Buckley's protagonist, Blackford Oakes, is tall, handsome, witty, amusing, endearing, compassionate, from which at least we can take satisfaction knowing that his work is not autobiographical.
I hope you sent him a rejoinder.
Did you? No,
you didn't have this in Right Reason. You should have had that letter. What was the first? Was Saving the Queen the first Blackford Oakes?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's a nice change of pace for you, isn't it? Writing the fiction, or is it, is it a labor of love?
Well, I find writing extremely difficult. Extremely... exhausting. But I write my books in Switzerland. And there, at least I have the relative seclusion. But I wrote a novel this year, last year, and the year before, which is three in a row. And that gets to be very heavy. I wouldn't want to have to write another one next February. Usually they're interrupted by a nonfiction book.
How do you chart your day? You've just stated that Right Reason represents perhaps 10% of the nonfiction writing you've done over the past 7 years or so. You've just turned out three novels in a row, and so you must. Plus, you have the harpsichord, and you have the sailboat, and you have the magazine. And I mean, how do you organize yourself in such a way to find time to do all the things that you do?
Well, I think all of us are dominated by deadlines. You have your deadlines, you meet them. I have my deadlines, and I meet them. It's true that I write fast. On the other hand, it's also true that I read slowly. So that it's every now and then, if I'm tempted to think of myself as extremely productive, I think of people like Johnson, for instance, or even contemporary Earl Stanley Gardner was able to write a book in 3 days, and Simenon took 6, 7, 8, 9 days. Johnson wrote Rasselas in 9 days. Mozart wrote his three most famous symphonies in the course of 6.5 weeks, 39th, 40th, and 41st. So I don't feel I have anything to be proud of, but I write fast, that's true.
How do you organize yourself to do this? You say, look, I'm writing between 9 and 4, and how does it work?
Oh, well, in the case of my books, I, I,
In Switzerland, I do my administrative work in the morning and my column, if it happens to be one of the 3 days per week that I have to write a column. Then I go out to lunch, then I ski for a couple of hours. Then I come back and check the office for anything that's vital. And then I begin writing around 5 o'clock, and I write 2.5 hours till 7:30. But if you write 2.5 hours and plod along, as you know, you can write 1,500 words. At the end of 5 weeks, you've got a book.
How often are you in Switzerland?
Every year.
For how long?
5-6 weeks.
And you do your novels during that period?
Yeah. Yeah. I do my books there.
You, of course, ran quite a few years ago, 65, I believe, for mayor of New York on the conservative ticket against, I guess, John Lindsay was the chief opponent that particular year. Do you have...
Well, he and Abe Beame were neck and neck.
Yeah. Yeah, he ran as a liberal, didn't he? No, he ran as a Republican. Liberal, I guess, 4 years later.
He ran as a Republican.
Yeah, he ran as a on the liberal line exclusively after I think John Markey got it 4 years
exactly.
After that
time. That's exactly what happened, yeah.
Did you enter that... you wrote a book called... Wasn't it called The Unmaking of a Mayor?
Correct.
So you talk a lot about that, but I have a... Just kind of have a feeling that so much water has passed under the bridge now. If you've had any additional thoughts about it, was it just a lark to do something like that, or were you really serious?
Well, it was a lark if you consider it a lark to run in a contest in which you know absolutely that you can't win. But by that token, Norman Thomas was engaged in larks between 1912 and 1948, or whenever it was he last ran. But it was a didactic venture. The idea was to spread the gospel and to show that other approaches to the problems of New York were thinkable and, in fact, were defensible, which God knows they were in both cases. So it made for spread the gospel. Remember this, that up until I ran for public office, the highest vote, if memory serves, that the fledgling Conservative Party had ever gone, it was 1%. And I got 13.5%. So that suggests that I was able to get the message out substantially. And 6 years later, my brother was elected senator. Mm-hmm. So that tremendous, tremendous progress. And the Republican Party was taken over by what one might call the Conservative wing, the Rockefeller-Javits Party ceased to exist.
The voters, in general, haven't been kind to writers who've run for office. As I remember Upton Sinclair ran, and
Henry George.
James Michener ran.
Henry George.
And Howard Fast ran on, a socialist ticket. Gore Vidal ran for Congress up, I think, in Putnam or Dutchess County.
Yeah, I had forgotten that Howard Fast ran.
Yeah. He ran on the ticket of the American Labor Party in early 1950s in the Bronx.
When he was a communist.
He was then a communist, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Although he didn't run on the communist line.
Well, it was hard to distinguish between the American Labor Party and the communist line those days.
Yeah.
You say they haven't been kind to writers. I think that's true, though they made Wilson president.
But he wasn't really considered a writer, though. He was more of a historian, wasn't he, as president of Princeton?
Yeah, he was an academic. You're quite correct.
Michener threw his heart into his campaign in Pennsylvania and lost.
That's right.
And Norman Mailer ran and lost. Jimmy Breslin?
Yes.
I'm not sure I'm going to see a writer named to a higher elective office in my lifetime.
I suppose another way to put it is there a writer in Congress? Well, Moynihan is one. He's certainly a writer. He was other things. It's hard to talk about people who are just writers. Michener would be one, I suppose, but most of them are something else besides their professors, or they're historians or academics or whatever. But to cede to your point, it's correct. It isn't a profession that generates a lot of legislators.
You're not going to run again just to make another point, are you?
No. No, I think I've done my jury duty. And I would just soon stick to the other media to make my criticisms.
I mentioned Vidal as an erstwhile candidate. Did you ever make peace with Gore? Are you speaking at all?
No, I don't run into him. No, look for opportunities to do so.
Yeah, he's been here a couple of times, and he was extremely disappointed when he and I sat down to talk, because I know that Gore had imagined something much larger than the small, single-manned broadcast that I did. I know he had expected a studio orchestra and a straight man, and some comedians and so forth to come out, and we just sat around the table just like this, and we talked about books, or tried to talk about books, and I wasn't very successful.
What was he pushing?
He had a couple of... I've talked to him a couple of times. One time it was a book called Myron.
Oh, Lord,
which was a sequel to Myra Breckinridge.
Yeah.
And another one was a book called Creation, which, as I recall, was set in ancient Greece. Remember that one? But I didn't talk to him the last time he was here. He was in promoting his book, Lincoln.
Right.
But I had felt that we'd covered as much ground as I could cover it up to that point.
So right.
He had plenty of opportunities to promote that. Well, harpsichording and sailing and painting, and I see here on this book that you did about 10 years ago, The Jeweler's Eye, you're on a motorcycle and you're scuba diving, and you certainly have a lot of irons in the fire in terms of hobbies and avocations, don't you?
Well, I'm very much of an amateur in most of those. My sailing is, I suppose, moderately proficient. I just sailed across the Pacific in June as skipper of my own vessel, and I have to write a book about that.
Oh, this was Airborne was a wonderful, wonderful book. It was one of my favorite
books.
Well,
I'm glad you like that.
So you're going to... You kept a detailed log again, I would assume.
Yes, I did, as did my son and a couple of others. There's a long piece about it in Life magazine, the current issue.
Mm-hmm.
With
an excerpt?
Pictures. Well, it's not an excerpt, but I wrote a piece. It's really a preview. It's a condensation isn't the correct way to put it, but it's 7,000 words off the back of my mind about an experience which will consume 100,000 words when I set it down in February and March. That's my next book.
These experiences, not only do they make books, but they really help to keep the mind alive, don't they? When you get yourself out there moving and doing things that are challenging, I think they just broaden you as a human being.
Well, that certainly is the conventional idea, that different exposure, active and passive, does keep your mind stretched, and I think probably does.
Well, I know people, and including family members, whose idea of a good time is to sit and relax in front of the television set every night and all weekend and watch the football games. And it just seems to me there's more to life. And it looks to me, based on what I've read, that the things that you've done, you are seeking out those things. And that makes you more attuned to what we're doing. And since it keeps your mind so alive, you're able to comment on things in a literate and timely fashion. I think that's very important. Do you have time to read the works of others?
Not nearly as much as I ought to have. That's probably my principal sacrifice. I wish I read fast. John Leonard once told me that he could read without any pain or whatever 14 books a week. And I'm absolutely appalled with envy at anybody who can find the time to do that, and also the speed to read that quickly. I suppose you probably don't find that all that odd, but that's not only my principal sacrifice, it's my principal delinquency.
Well, essentially all John has had to do is read 14 books and then write a couple of columns about them. So he has.
That's right, yeah, that's what he does, sure.
But most other people have other duties to do, and I do I turn out 5 columns a week on books and writers, and sometimes I interview as many as 5 or 6 people a week. Sometimes less.
Well, you probably read very fast. Then,
I read very fast, but I have other duties to do. I mean, I'm a journalist, broadcast journalist.
Sure.
I have other things that I have to do in addition to this, because CBS love the company and they like the broadcast, but they're not going to pay me just to read books and voice my opinions about them. I wish they would. That's a wonderful job. John was able to do that. I read about 5 or 6 books a week. But I do focus on relatively important nonfiction and literature and poetry. And so it's an ambitious attempt, and so I do feel the pressure. But I enjoy it. Do you read fiction at all?
Oh, sure.
What do you like?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I was a comprehensive student of any single school. I'm not. I read a little bit of everything. I'm trying to think what last... I think the last book of fiction I read was the submarine book. Fascinating. Absolutely.
The Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, right. What fascinated me is that anybody could so dominate the technical literature as to be able to produce a book of that complexity. If I had been asked to be as familiar with, say, a U-2 plane as he was with a submarine, to be sure, the one being much more complex than the other, I simply couldn't have done it. I just don't have the capability of doing it. So I found it an absolutely admirable book from that point of view alone.
Well, Tom Clancy has never had any nautical background and, in fact, is an insurance man in Owings, Maryland.
I know. That's what makes all the more remarkable. A lot of that is obviously mimetic. Somebody told him what to say here and how to put it, but the very fact that he bought it off so with such conviction, I thought was a tremendous demonstration.
Well, there's lots of good stuff out there, so as you pack for your trip to Switzerland, you have to salt away a few copies to read on the airplane, and as well as, I guess you do read a substantial amount of nonfiction as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah, well, I think, isn't it true of all of us that when we're not writing or or eating, we're reading? I mean, that's what one does, isn't it?
That's what I do. William Buckley, it's been a treat because I've followed you for so many years, and so it was a real treat for me. I'm delighted that Doubleday encouraged you to spend this day making a few appearances.
Well, thank you for your invitation.
This was a delight for me, and I enjoyed Right Reason, and I thank you very much for coming in and talking to me.
Nice to see you.